Welcome to Heavy Networking from the Packet Pushers. Today we're going to go deep on cloud-based security, remote user access, and zero trust. This is a sponsored show. Our sponsor is Zscaler. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm at Drew_CM on Twitter, and Ethan Banks is here with me as well. He is at EC Banks. Ethan, you and I just finished talking to an amazing guest. What did you take away from this conversation?
Well, you can do anything and everything that you want security-wise in the cloud, and they have a very plausible story for that. So for folks that are used to, I have to have a firewall that does all these things at the branch and do it all myself. You actually don't. Zscaler can handle that. But that was just the beginning of the conversation, Drew. We got into this discussion about ZPA, the Zscaler private access product, which is a VPN replacement, but that's far from all it does, and got right into the nitty-gritty of how it worked. So I walked away with more than my brain could handle. I would have to listen to this two or three times to get all of the information that Lisa, our guest, shared fully cemented into my consciousness.
Yeah, and I just want to be clear, this isn't a marketing show. Lisa took us on a packet walk through how ZPA works. We got into the weeds. We did some nitty gritty. So yeah, let's get into it. Today, we're talking with Lisa Lorenzen. She is Director of Transformation Strategy at Zscaler. Lisa, welcome to the podcast. And for listeners who aren't familiar with Zscaler, can you give us the two-sentence overview?
Sure. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. So Zscaler has a global cloud platform on which we deliver a digital exchange that can carry traffic to and from both the internet, software as a service applications that are publicly accessible, as well as private applications in the data center and on cloud providers like AWS and Azure. Zscaler has been in operation for about 11 years now, with the outbound secure web gateway service. And about 5 years ago, we introduced the Zscaler private access service, which is a cloud-enabled zero trust access solution.
Okay, that's great. And we're going to get into all of that. But as we were preparing for the show behind the scenes, you had mentioned that Zscaler has been ramping up capacity to support increased demand. And for context, we're recording this as companies are gearing up for employees to work from home because of the pandemic. So can you give us a little insight on what's happening on the back end at Zscaler and its POPs?
Sure. So the week of March 16th, the beginning of that week, we saw a 300% global increase in our private access traffic overnight. Wow. And that is the service that allows us to securely connect users to internal applications in the data center or cloud. Uh-huh. So as you can imagine, with the big push to telework, work from home, in the desire to get some social distance and protect the health and safety of employees, a lot of companies are really focused on enabling a much larger user population for remote access and finding that traditional remote access solutions don't scale to meet that demand. So we've seen a big increase in utilization of our private access service. And as a result, we had hotspots in particular areas where a company that had 10,000 ZPA users suddenly needed to enable 50,000, for example.
Wow.
So we did a lot of expansion of capacity on a very short notice basis. We did some traffic distribution to distribute traffic across multiple nodes in our cloud. So normally where a user would be connected to the closest geographic cloud broker, now they may be redirected to a cloud broker that's slightly farther away but under less load.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really an example that, you know, at the end of the day, the cloud still is only other people's computers. But what's important here is that we've had these computers for a long time and we know what we need to do to scale in a hurry.
Lisa, a customer of yours had an essay they posted on LinkedIn. They had that challenge, getting a lot of users working remotely. Can you give us a little background on that story? Because I love hearing how people are solving problems. That's the real world.
Oh, yeah. So DB Schenker was the example, and their CIO, I am not going to mangle his name, but you can find this post on LinkedIn. He did a great write-up of how they enabled their business continuity plan with Zscaler, and they scaled up 75,000 users in 4 weeks. So they were able to take about a week to test out the solution and validate that it was going to work, and then to ramp up those users for remote access using the cloud service and really enable work from home without a lot of internal disruption.
Yeah, that's pretty good because all of this is happening so fast. And in other channels, we've been talking to folks who are having to like literally buy new physical appliances and deal with licenses and try to get that all done as this onrush of new workers are coming online.
Oh, yeah. I saw a tweet recently from a Twitter user who said they'd called CDW to try to expand their VPN solution, and CDW told them that VPN gateway licenses were backordered for 3 weeks. Now, a license is a virtual electronic component. Yeah. I'm not sure how you backorder that, but that's an example of the kind of, you know, maybe frustrations or new challenges when you have an unprecedented move like this.
Yeah, so that sort of ties into my next question, because, you know, a typical design for mobile workers and for branch offices was to backhaul everything to the data center because that's where all the security gear was, all the appliances were, or you want to duplicate all those appliances out at branch or remote sites. Everything's moving to the cloud, but I also know there's a core of sort of skeptical network and security folks who may be reluctant to relinquish those physical boxes and trust that all their traffic is going to get the proper scrubbing through a cloud-based broker. How do you broach that with folks?
Well, I start off by saying I was that person 5 years ago. I worked for NetScreen/Juniper Network/PulseSecure before I came to Zscaler. Mm-hmm. And I was a subject matter expert on our firewall, VPN, and NAC solutions. And to be honest, for the last 5 years that I worked at Juniper and Pulse, if you said cloud to me, I said go away. Because as far as I could tell, you were just moving your problems from your rack to somebody else's rack. Yes. That you couldn't reboot.
Right.
So I come to that conversation with a whole lot of sympathy for the perspective that we've done it this way for 20 years and it has worked just fine. How do we know that if we make such a big topological change that we're going to have the same level of protection and control that we used to have? And really, the answer is, if you think about outbound web traffic, there's a variety of visibility and control that you want to be able to apply to that. Everything from URL filtering, anti-malware, sandboxing, outbound firewall, antivirus, and IPS. Mm-hmm. And so you had different boxes in a stack of appliances at the edge of the data center. And like you say, users that were remote or in branches, the traffic was all backhauled to the data center to go out that stack of appliances. And what we've done is we have re-implemented those services in a cloud service where we can apply URL filtering, full-scale SSL decryption, looking for malicious traffic, which is really difficult to do in physical hardware at scale, cloud sandbox, cloud firewall, IPS, DLP, CASB, all of that realm of services. And the way that we provide the performance and the scale that we need to do that on a multi-tenant global system is we actually run all of those engines simultaneously. So we call it single scan multi-action. Instead of pushing that packet through a series of different gates, which is going to slow it down with every transition, we load it into memory, hit it with everything at once, and then the administrator has the choice of whether to use this only for visibility or whether to start to apply enforcement on that traffic. So when you talk to somebody who's accustomed to that model, you really end up saying, look, put us in line outside of your existing controls. See what you catch with us, and then start to migrate away from your existing controls one service at a time. If you feel like we're doing well enough on the firewall, then maybe rely on our cloud firewall versus your outbound firewall policy set. And maybe that means you can decommission 300 small firewalls at your branches, right, or URL filtering or DLP. And so we really try to make it rather than, you know, eat the elephant all at once, to say, okay, you know, here, take a bite out of this, take a bite out of that, work your way into your own comfort level. And that's just for the outbound service. For the inbound solution, for Zscaler Private Access, we have a similar transitional approach. If you have a traditional IPsec VPN, you can't run two VPN clients on the same endpoint. If you try to install, let's say, PulseSecure and Cisco on the same device, they're going to conflict with each other because they both need to leverage the same parts of the IP stack. With Zscaler, we don't use a traditional IPsec VPN model. All of our traffic is intercepted and sent into TLS tunnels. So the Zscaler private access solution can coexist with a VPN solution. So again, we say, look, you've got this VPN concentrator at the edge of the network. You've got to scale it, so you've probably got local load balancing. it has an inbound listener, so you have to have it in a DMZ, external and internal firewalls. You're protecting that inbound listener with denial of service protection. And if you've got multiple sites, you're probably doing some kind of DSLB. All of those functions move into the cloud service, similar to the outbound. So we don't have an inbound listener. Instead of the VPN gateway, we put a lightweight component in the application environment. It makes an outbound-only connection to our cloud. That means you don't need the DMZ protection. You don't need denial of service protection because there's just no attack surface there. And then we distribute the traffic across these groups of connectors based on reachability to the application and proximity to the user. So you don't need clustering, load balancing, or DSLB. So what we say again is stand this up in parallel. Run it on the same system as a test user with a VPN. Tell them when they come in this morning or when they start to work, don't connect your VPN tunnel. You've got a new component that should carry your traffic. If you hit anything that doesn't work, okay, click on this new icon, turn off ZPA, then reconnect your VPN, but let us know what didn't work so we can troubleshoot it. And so what we find is that by giving, you know, skeptical network and security administrators the ability to kick the tires without really committing to jumping off a cliff and hoping their wings work, then we can give them the comfort level that they have to shift from a connectivity model or a control model that was really built for a world that doesn't exist anymore to a service that's designed for the cloud and mobile environments that we operate in today.
Okay, Lisa, you just galloped across a field of daisies on your unicorn, a rainbow of Zscaler functionality behind you, and a lot of people that are skeptical are sitting like going, come on, Lisa, you just told me I can get rid of a firewall and I can get rid of IPS, and now maybe I don't need VPN. You spouted off all these things that Zscaler is going to do for me, so we got to back this up a little bit here.
Absolutely.
So let's go to a common scenario a lot of folks are facing where I know you guys play, and it has been context for this conversation. That is, if I'm migrating away from that centralized backhauling all my traffic to HQ model because I want to go direct internet access. Maybe I've got a lot of stuff in cloud. I'm using SD-WAN services now, let's say. So a lot of traffic that didn't used to leave my branch is now leaving my branch directly. But let's put Zscaler in the mix there. To be secure and have and offer direct internet access to my remote offices, what do I still have to have on premises? Can I get away with just a stateful firewall and Zscaler does the rest? I think you even said I can get away without a firewall in some context. So we got to dig into this, Lisa.
Sure. So ideally, yes, you can get away without a firewall. You're going to need some component at the edge of that branch to route traffic. And so that routing could be a small router. It could be an SD-WAN device. That's going to send traffic to Zscaler based on an IPsec or GRE tunnel to our cloud. Mm-hmm. If you choose to bypass some traffic out of Zscaler, then it's going to send it directly to your upstream internet provider. And the third way that we would capture traffic is the Zscaler agent or browser-based access capturing traffic to internal applications that would normally go over a site-to-site VPN out of that legacy branch firewall or an MPLS connection that you're now paying for that bandwidth. So if you have a branch that has entirely outbound traffic, there's no inbound connectivity, then all you really need is a way to route traffic upstream, a tunnel connection to Zscaler, and the Zscaler agent to carry internal traffic.
The tunnel option is pretty straightforward. I think a lot of folks that listen to this are going to be familiar with that. I'm going to set up a GRE tunnel. I'm going to be pushing traffic through that tunnel up to Zscaler. Zscaler is going to catch my traffic, and then You're going to do what? You're going to catch it on the way back as well in some way and then route it back through the GRE tunnel to me?
Absolutely. So the outbound service is a full proxy in the cloud, and it allows us to intercept that traffic. And this is where we apply the outbound enforcement controls for threat prevention, for data protection, for access control. So URL filtering, cloud firewall, cloud sandbox, SSL decryption, data leak protection, et cetera. That's the outbound service. And then for the inbound service, we're the other way around. We don't want to crack open those packets to private applications because that is our customer's intellectual property. And let me tell you, if it's a regulated industry, so if they're in the healthcare business and they're subject to HIPAA, if they're in the retail or any business that's subject to PCI, if they're in an industrial controls environment or a critical infrastructure environment that, you know, maybe they've got the NERC SIPs to contend with, they don't want us in their security boundary. And frankly, we don't want to be there. So for private access, our focus is on delivering that traffic dynamically and on being able to prove both to the customer and the customer to prove to an auditor or regulator that we do not have any exposure to that traffic.
So Lisa, if I'm using that GRE tunnel model, do I even need to NAT that traffic before I send it to Zscaler?
Yeah, so you would still need that component at the edge of the network for outbound traffic that's going to take RFC 1918 space and turn it into a public IP address. But that's only for the outbound service. For the inbound service, for private traffic, we actually provide a synthetic IP on the local endpoint, and then we drop that traffic into a TLS tunnel. And at that point, those TLS tunnels that we use to carry private traffic really act a lot like an MPLS path, a label switched path. So what happens there is you have an outbound TLS tunnel from the agent to a cloud broker. You have an outbound TLS tunnel from a connector to the cloud broker. And those two tunnels are stitched together at the broker using a microtunnel ID. Those tunnels are used to create an end-to-end path for the traffic from the end user to the back-end application. And as that traffic transits the tunnel, it is never written to disk. It's only held in memory. So it's never data at rest. It's always data in transit. Now, we're going to send that as a byte stream. So if that is sensitive traffic going over a legacy unencrypted transport like HTTP or Telnet, because, you know, we never thought anybody outside the company was going to hit that web server, so we never bothered to put an SSL certificate on it, then you do have the question of, okay, now I've got clear text HTTP exposed in memory in the broker. But for that scenario, we have a feature called double encryption, which does exactly what it says on the tin. The customer can use their own PKI, make an end-to-end encrypted TLS tunnel inside the two outbound TLS tunnels, and you can drop any unencrypted sensitive traffic into that. So the upshot is we have the ability to carry outbound traffic to internet and software as a service, do content inspection on it, and then we have the ability to carry inbound private traffic to data center or cloud services, and we can protect that traffic in ways that not only can external attackers not see it, but even Zscaler can't see it.
One thing I wanted to go back to was just getting traffic to Zscaler. So we talked about the tunnel, a GRE tunnel. One more little bit of subtext there, because you brought up the HTTP and Telnet traffic, unencrypted data flows that might be going through that tunnel. So is that GRE, but also IPsec if I want to turn that on?
So I need to make a distinction between the outbound service and the inbound service.
Okay.
The outbound service is where we would carry traffic to internet and software as a service. That is our Zscaler internet access. And so that would go up the GRE or IPsec tunnel. And there's no reason to encrypt that traffic because it's publicly accessible traffic.
It's publicly accessible traffic that you presume is already encrypted or you're doing it wrong. Yeah.
Bingo. Yes. It is the inbound service, our Zscaler private access, where confidentiality and integrity are critical. And so the inbound service is where we apply the TLS tunnels for transport and stitch them together at a cloud broker. And that's also where we apply the double encryption option for unencrypted internal applications. So we have the ability to carry outbound traffic and inspect it without adding any overhead. We have the ability to carry inbound traffic and fully protect it.
Got it. And you have been very clear about the inbound versus outbound traffic, but, but sometimes you got to say it more than once before the thick skulls here. That's me.
It took me a while as well.
Okay. One more question about...
Go ahead.
Just one more question about access, Lisa. That is, you had mentioned something in the browser, like I would be installing, I don't know what it would be, a plugin or is it a proxy setting? What would I be installing in a client's browser to get data over to Zscaler?
So there are two different forwarding paths for an end device that is not on-premise, not carrying traffic over a tunnel. For the outbound service, those forwarding paths are the Zscaler app or a pack file. For the inbound service, those forwarding paths are the Zscaler app again, same application, or the ability to carry web traffic directly in the browser. And that does not require any kind of plugin or extension or software installation at all. So unlike some of the SSL VPN solutions where you have to load some form of software, it may not be a FAT client, but it is software that runs in the browser, we leverage TLS tunnels that the browser can form natively, and we leverage a DNS CNAME to redirect the traffic to Zscaler's cloud. So all we really have to do is get the traffic to the cloud, and then ZPA processes it as same as if it were coming out of the Zscaler app.
Oh, got it. Now, for Zscaler clients, I'm just curious, do you see a typical pattern where most of them do the GRE model or most of them do the model you just described with the browser?
Yeah, so for private access, generally speaking, we see most of our customers using ZApp for employees and for any third party where they have enough of a relationship to want to manage software on the device, to want to require a particular device or a particular level of awareness of the device. So employees, you generally have ZApp. And then browser access is incredibly useful for third-party access or B2B type of access. So that could be a vendor who just needs access to the web interface for an HVAC system, for example, and you don't want them to be able to have lateral movement to other things. Or a customer where you want to give visibility, so this is the customer of our customer, and you have some kind of B2B relationship, a supplier, a partner, et cetera, and you want to give them access, again, to applications you don't want to publicly expose, but you cannot require them to install software.
Okay, so you've talked about Zscaler Private Access, or ZPA, and Zero Trust. Can you dig more into what you mean by Zero Trust? Because that's a term that's getting thrown around a lot. So I want to understand how you position that. And then also, we can dig into a little bit more around ZPA.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who's heard me on this topic before can anticipate the next thing I'm going to say, which is that Zero Trust is a terrible term, and I wish that it would go away. And particularly, I feel so the term Zero Trust was introduced about 10 years ago. And John Kindervag was with Forrester at the time. He wrote a wonderful white paper, No More Chewy Centers. And it was the M&M security model where you've got a hard, crunchy exterior and a soft interior. Yeah. And his point a decade ago was that we have more visibility and control for remote users accessing internal applications than we do for on-premise users. At least a remote user had to come in through a VPN. You had full visibility of who was coming in. You could possibly apply some ACLs in the VPN tunnel. So we were connecting the endpoint to the network, but we had more control over the remote user connected to the network than the on-premise user connected to the network. And that was a great point, and it was definitely a goal to have zero implicit trust even in your on-premise users, or to put it differently, we don't trust you any more in your cubicle than we do in a Starbucks. Uh-huh. The problem was that 10 years ago, it was damn near impossible. And I say that as someone who spent about 10 years as Juniper and then PulseSecure's NAC subject matter expert. I was a principal solution architect and I was focused on NAC. And we had layer 2 admission control with 802.1x and Radius. We had layer 3 identity aware stateful firewall. We tied that into our VPN so you could federate all of this so that you had full visibility and control of the user on-premise or off-premise. And I feel like at Pulse, we had one of the most end-to-end, robust, and mature solutions in the industry. But I would still say that out of the majority of the NAC projects that I worked on and helped customers with, I rarely saw any NAC solution that accomplished at the end of the project 100% of the goal at the beginning.
Right.
And that's because we found is true almost in anything, 80% of the problem takes the first 20% of the time. And the last 20% of the problem either takes forever or it isn't accomplishable. So moving into a world of cloud and mobility, you're just taking that problem set and expanding it, because now not only do we have to protect users that are coming from everywhere, but we have to deal with applications that are no longer on-premise. And now we have applications in a cloud provider or multiple cloud providers as IaaS or PaaS, you may have a single business policy that you have to express in a data center firewall ACL plus an AWS security group plus ACLs in the Microsoft Azure environment. So zero trust really doesn't accommodate what we're trying to accomplish anymore. And what we're really trying to accomplish is context-based trust. You have to trust someone. Let's figure out what we can trust and what we need in order to trust that. So I want to take a user and I want to start with that assumption that we're not going to trust them any more on-premise than we do off-premise. But I want to break it down a little further. What's their role in the organization? Maybe what location are they coming from? What device are they coming from? Is it a managed or unmanaged device? Is it a corporate asset or government furnished equipment, or is it a personal device? So there's a whole lot of context of attributes of a request. And then I want to use that as my source for the request rather than using an IP pool off a VPN versus a subnet that's on-premise. And the target of the request changes as well, because I don't just want to say, okay, you can get to my entire server segment, and then I'm going to use network segmentation to control where you can get from there. I want to say, you can get to this particular application, but if you're not authorized for anything else, then that's all you can see. So if you've got a web server on the back end, you know, you've generally got at least two user communities, but the two big ones are web service consumers and web server administrators. And you may want to give your web service consumers access to that web server on 80 and 443. You may want to give your administrators access on 3389 or 22 or both, you know, depending on the underlying OS. So I don't want to have to try to control that based on a source IP or subnet. I want to control that based on who the requester is, whether they're on a managed device or not, what their context is. And then I want to be able to say, okay, all of my web server consumers can only get to the web service itself. Only the web administrators are allowed to get to the back-end OS to manage the system. So we really want to make this granular, context-based access that is user-centric and application-centric. And I think that that's where the original concept of zero trust needs to expand beyond are you on-premise or off-premise,
right,
to accommodate all of these other factors.
So to read that back to you, what I'm taking away is when Zscaler is talking about zero trust, you're saying that starts with user identity, device type, device location, and what services they're trying to access. And that's where you
possibly go. Even some posture about the device. It's really how much context can you gather and what of that context do you want to use as criteria for access?
Right. And then from there, you can enforce more fine-grained access policies as opposed to bam, I'm on the network.
Right. And unlike a traditional VPN, where, you know, an IPsec VPN, that's a layer 3 tunnel into your network. If you want to restrict users from touching things, you have to either put ACLs in the tunnel or in the network or both. With ZPA, we're the other way around. We're least privileged. We define what the user can get to, and that's the only thing they can see. Now, I will back up a step there and say, before I was at NetScreen, I was actually at Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina. And for whatever sins I committed in a previous life, I ran our client-to-gateway and business-to-business VPNs on a big honking checkpoint cluster with StoneSoft load balancing on Nokia hardware.
Yeah.
So if anybody out there has been in that position, I feel you, you know? And what we had to do then was to say, okay, we're going to open these VPN tunnels. And then if we need to lock people out of things, we need to figure out exactly what we need to lock out. That was hard enough. If you'd come to me at Blue Cross and said to me, I can give you a service that will let you define policy for what users can get to which applications, I would have said, well, that's nice, but I don't even know what applications are all running in my environment, let alone who can get to what.
Right.
And I think that's still true for a lot of organizations today. So we do have the ability to configure ZPA in an application discovery mode where you take a trusted group of pilot users and you give them access to an entire application domain, star.corp.zscaler.com, for example, star.internal.yourcompany.com. And then ZPA is going to carry traffic to anything that they can reach in that, any host name in that domain. But it's also going to give the administrators a dashboard of discovered applications. And for any application, you can drill into it and see who touched it. So in that way, ZPA can help answer those questions. What applications are being accessed over this service and who is doing the access? And then the ZPA administrator can pop out those applications, one application or one set of applications at a time, and create more granular policy sort of above, quote unquote, your general connectivity policy, because we are a top-down first match rule set. So if I've got my wildcard domain and any pilot user can access it at the bottom of my rule set, and then I see that a bunch of people are accessing a finance server, I can write a policy that says only finance users can touch the finance server, put that above my wildcard. And so you can really build a granular policy, one user community at a time or one resource at a time, again, while still enabling different users to cycle through that connectivity policy so that you can see, okay, here's what finance users need to get to. Here's what this third-party consultant who's sitting on-premise needs to get to. Here's what my engineering users need to get to, et cetera. And if you know that you have sensitive resources that you need to lock down, you can have those policies from the beginning so that they never fall into the application discovery realm as well. So we're really giving customers the ability to start from that open model. Everything internal is connectable over the VPN, but then whittle it down in a manageable fashion and with whatever priority they put on their different use cases or their different resources.
But this also presumes that the customer has done a good job in neatly categorizing their directory of employees and groups and categories.
Oh, yes, it does. Identity and access management is the third rail of zero trust. And that may also not be true. It may be that you have not only an open layer 3 network internally, but an Active Directory domain that everybody's in the same group. So you can develop IAM maturity using this application discovery process at the same time that you develop a more granular access policy. I would say that's going to slow down the speed at which you can add different use cases to the solution, because you're building all of the wheels under the moving car, but it can be done. And we see a lot of organizations do it that way.
Where does the enforcement happen in this, the solution, the ZPA solution, Lisa? And I ask it in this context. There's a lot of micro-segmentation solutions, which are more about machine-to-machine comms and protecting your data center in there. They also do a discovery process, and they also build policy. And then where that policy lives varies widely depending on what the solution is. So this sounds somewhat similar, only we're dealing with, you know, VPN, remote user access. Where does the enforcement happen?
The enforcement lives in the cloud. And let me sort of break that down by doing a very little bit of a packet walk here, because I think that'll help illustrate what happens. We have three primary components to ZPA. You have the agent on the endpoint that we've already talked about. It can carry any client-to-server TCP and UDP traffic, and it intercepts that traffic and throws it into these outbound TLS tunnels. You have the connector in the application environment. And these connectors are lightweight virtual instances. They're cattle, not pets. You load an RPM, or better yet, you load a pre-built hardened OVA or AMI. That component, you put a provisioning key on it, phones home to the cloud, and suddenly you have a connector in that environment. So now we have the ability to capture the traffic and the ability to deliver the traffic. Those two components are as simple as possible, because we want as little complexity in the end user space, in the application space, as we can get. All of the intelligence is in the broker. And so the cloud broker is the, if you think about it in terms of XACML, which, you know, again, God help me, I spent too long in standards bodies, you have the concept of a policy decision point and a policy enforcement point. And then you also have a policy administration point. So our cloud brokers are effectively both the policy decision point and the policy enforcement point, in that the policy resides in the broker. When ZApp intercepts some private traffic and sends the request for that application up to the cloud broker is first going to look to see whether the user has a fresh enough SAML assertion. So we're going to authorize users via SAML IDP, and the administrator can set a scale for how old that SAML assertion is allowed to be before they must go get a new one. So number one, do you have a fresh enough SAML assertion? And then number two, are you allowed to get what you're asking for? And that's why we care how fresh the SAML assertion is, because that's going to give us the SAML attributes that feed into that policy decision. So packet comes into ZPA via ZApp. The policy decision is made by the broker. If the user is not allowed to access the resource, packet goes no further. We don't deliver the traffic to the connector. If the user doesn't have a fresh enough SAML assertion, we'll redirect them to the IDP to get a fresh enough SAML assertion. Then we make the policy decision. If the traffic is permitted, then the ZPA service is going to identify the best connector to deliver the traffic. And that's where the connector is going to reach out to the cloud broker and form the other half of those outbound-only connections that meet in the middle. So what's really happening there is all the agent has to do is recognize that the traffic is for ZPA and send the request along with the SAML assertion to start that policy decision process. And all the connector has to do is let the cloud service know whether it can reach a requested application and what reachability it has, and then deliver traffic to the application once it sees it coming down the outbound TLS tunnel. So we've tried to simplify the edge as much as possible and put all of the intelligence in the cloud broker. The one other piece I mentioned is the policy administration point. And that's where you configure policy. That's where you look at these logs, at the health dashboards, the user activity dashboards, whatever. And that is also hosted in the Zscaler cloud. So you've got two cloud components, the central authority and the broker. And then you've got two edge components, which are the agent on the endpoint or the web browser making the request if it's a web app only, and the connector in the backend environment.
You mentioned a packet causing this all of this activity to take place. But I'm assuming once the first packet of a flow has been authenticated appropriately, permitted by policy, and then sent on, everything else in the flow is just going to be allowed through. You're going to put some kind of an entry in there to just let it be on its way.
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is a lot like, I think I mentioned I started off at NetScreen and we had slow path and fast path for traffic. And the slow path was the policy decision for whether to allow the packet through. And then the fast path was going through the ASIC on an established session. So you can think of ZPA as also having this sort of control plane, data plane model. Once the request has come up to ZPA, ZPA has determined that the user is permitted access, the appropriate connector has been identified, all of that happens over persistent outbound TLS tunnels that you can think of as control plane. Once that decision is made, the connector makes a new dynamic transient outbound TLS tunnel to the user's broker. And the user's agent also makes a new dynamic TLS tunnel to the same broker. And we converge at the user's broker because that moves the edge of the service as close to the user as possible. Because usually the user's uplink is the least performant, lowest bandwidth link in the chain. So now these dynamic TLS tunnels are set up, and any traffic that matches that application request is just going to continue to go through the data plane. And we have a certain amount of stickiness. So let's say I walk away and get a cup of coffee and then I come back and hit the same website. That's going to be a continuation of an existing request. You know, 5-10 minutes, I may have to, because it's a new request, my SAML assertion is going to get rechecked. If something's changed in those 5 minutes, like I'm no longer in a group that's allowed to get there, then you probably wanted to know that. But it's not going to do a full dynamic path selection again. On the other hand, if I go get lunch and I come back and I make that request, then we may go all the way through path selection again to say, what's the best broker for the traffic? What's the best connector for the traffic, et cetera.
Can I use ZPA in conjunction with SD-WAN?
Yeah, absolutely. Because really those are two different, they're complementary services. So SD-WAN is really going to be how you route traffic to internet and software as a service. And then the upstream Zscaler traffic to get to a ZPA broker is going to go out that way as well. Okay, so SD-WAN is going to get the traffic up to the internet. ZPA is going to take over from there, or sort of ride that path to get it to a ZPA broker and get the backend delivery.
So you'll essentially respect the path choice that the SD-WAN appliance has made.
Right, because that's the path that the TLS tunnel from the agent to the ZPA broker is going to follow.
Got it. Okay.
The only other thing there is I briefly touched on the SAML assertion reassessment. And the one challenge with using SAML, so SAML is great for authorization. One of the biggest benefits to us is it means that we are never in possession of your customer's authentication credentials or material. So we just go throw them over to your IDP, we get an answer back, and we authorize traffic based on that. But the challenge is that it's generally one directional. The only time we get an updated answer is when we go make them ask the question again, right? If you need to get a fresh SAML assertion, we have to redirect users over there. And that's generally done by a re-authentication timeout that's really just how fresh does your SAML assertion have to be to get to this app. So that can be set globally or on a per app basis. What I'm really excited about here is that Zscaler has started to implement SCIM, which I think impacts to Secure Communication for Identity Management, if I remember that acronym correctly. And what SCIM is it allows the SAML IDP to signal to us when something changes. So we no longer have to say, you need to re-authenticate every 24 hours. We can say, if this user is terminated, the IDP will signal ZPA. So
just in case, you're going to get notified that something has changed, so you know you have a reason. Yeah.
And that reduces the number of unnecessary reauthentications the user has to perform. So we've already integrated SCIM for the outbound service, and we're working our way through SCIM integrations with the various IDP providers on ZPA. And when we get to the full extent of that, we will get SCIM notifications not only for terminations or deletion, but also for a modification. And at that point, as far as I'm concerned, you can basically turn off periodic reauthentication, because we shouldn't need it anymore. We should be told when something changes. So that's something to look forward to.
No, Lisa, we've been nerding out with a lot of detail about how this service works, this ZPA service, right down to a packet walk even. Let's back out a little bit, you know, zoom out, you know, take the drone up to some higher altitude.
Okay.
Where does ZPA fit for me as a company? Because I have maybe applications on premises and some in the cloud, and I've got a bunch of remote users, I don't know where they are, then ZPA kind of makes sense?
Sure. So we see four major drivers for Zscaler private access today. And this is based on what problems companies tell us that they need us to solve for them. So the obvious one is an alternative to a traditional VPN. And very often the driver for that is they want to eliminate the attack surface of the inbound listening port. They want to eliminate the single ingress point, the requirement to backhaul traffic. They want to improve the user experience. They want to eliminate the VPN concentrator's dependency on all that other infrastructure, the CapEx and OpEx involved in that stack of appliances at the edge of the network. So I would say that VPN alternative is probably the easiest use case to wrap your head around, because a VPN is something that almost every company has, and almost every company has their own issues with VPN. So not only do we understand what we're replacing, but why. But there are a few other use cases that have really come to us. Customers have said, these are things that we want to solve, and we want to use this technology to solve them. One of the big ones there is mergers and acquisitions. So if you acquire a company, or if you end up in a merger with another company, generally speaking, one of the top priorities is to connect key users to critical resources as close to day one as possible, right?
It is absolutely that. I've been through several M&A operations, and that's the first thing that happens. Hey, we're buying this company. How soon can the devs have access to this server, and that server? It's like, it's always a painful question, but yes, I've been there many times.
Because the pain involved is you've got to get circuits provisioned. That can take anywhere from days to weeks, even months, if you're really unlucky in your telco. But it's okay, because you need that time, because you need to do a security hygiene assessment on both sides. And you also need to do an IP assessment, because guess what? we are all on the 10 net in the data center. And so you may very well have IP overlap. And the joy of IP overlap is that we also have critical applications that are still hard coding licenses to IP addresses because the 90s called and they want their licensing scheme back. So we can't get away from this. And this means you end up with really complicated sets of NAT and ACLs and proxies that you need to develop at the boundary between the two networks in order to let those packets through. And what we can do with ZPA is eliminate all of that for user to application traffic. If you drop a set of connectors, let's say I acquire a company. If I drop a set of connectors into their environment, suddenly I can give my users access to any application in their environment. If I add their users to my SAML IDP, or better yet, let's just add their SAML IDP to my ZPA tenant, then I don't even reinvent that wheel. And now I can start to write policy to give their users access to my applications. So we have ability to reduce that day one integration process from months or weeks to literally days.
And the way you're obfuscating the destinations, overlapping IP address space, a problem with pretty much every M&A I was involved with, that does go away for me?
It does, because, so can I nerd out for just another minute? I promise it's relevant.
Please do.
Okay. When I type in jira.corp.zscaler.com, because that is defined as an application in ZPA, private application, ZApp is going to intercept that traffic. Let's say I'm using the agent, and it's going to return immediately to that DNS query a 100.64 address. So that's an address in carrier-grade NAT space, and it is local to my machine. It's a synthetic IP. And then ZApp is going to send that host name as part of the traffic request up to ZPA. And ZPA is going to look at what connectors are eligible to deliver traffic to that hostname, and those connectors are going to do the DNS query. So that means if I have files.companya.com on 10.115 in the parent company, and I've got webserver.companyb.com on 10.115 in the acquired company, it doesn't matter because they're in two different DNS domain namespaces. The traffic is really almost getting routed first by DNS domain to the appropriate connector, and then the connector does the DNS lookup.
And then my connectivity to connectivity is effectively a translation service that's going on there, it sounds like.
Yeah, we're really making a layer of abstraction between the user's request and the backend resource. Now, if you have somebody like a network administrator who's used to SSHing into every switch by IP address, they're not going to want to give that up either. And so we do have the ability to define single IPs or IP ranges as ZPA applications. And in that case, the administrator can continue to SSH by IP address, but you lose, the trade-off is you lose that ability to handle overlapping IP.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. So as everything, there's a trade-off. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So we've talked about M&A. And the flip side, to return to your original question, use cases driving this, the flip side of an M&A is a divestiture or a spinoff. And so I've been through the whole ringer. I've been bought. I've been sold. I've been at a company that went bankrupt. And a divestiture, when Pulse was spun off of Juniper, we had a transition service agreement. I think the original agreement was for 6 months where we could still use applications in Juniper's environment.
Oh, wow.
And so Juniper let us in through a VPN, but we could either be connected to the Pulse VPN or the Juniper VPN, and I'm sure they had to do a lot on the back end to determine who was allowed to get to what. If you think about it, a divestiture or a spinoff is really just a pathological case of third-party access. These used to be your employees, but they're not anymore. Now they're like any partner or contractor. You want to give them access to one particular thing or one set of things without connecting them to your entire network. So that's the big driver is that for the, another use case is divestitures, spinoffs, or other third-party access like partners, contractors, consultants. And the fourth big use case is migration of applications from data center to cloud. And then also the data center consolidation that comes along with it. And this is where eliminating backhaul really matters. And it's also, again, where you get a huge benefit from connecting users to a host name rather than IP address. Let's say you've got an application that's running in your data center and you're building that application in AWS. So your developers need to get to it in AWS. Your end users still need to get to it in the data center. But when you do the cutover, you don't necessarily want to have to retrain all of those users for how to find that application. And you definitely don't want to be bringing them into the data center, carrying their traffic up Direct Connect to AWS, back to the data center, and back out the VPN.
Good Lord.
So what ZPA allows you to do is to carry that traffic directly to AWS for the developers. The end users still access the application in the data center. And then when you cut over from the data center to the cloud, you simply shift which set of connectors is authoritative for that application. And all of a sudden, all the end user traffic goes to the cloud instead of the data center without the users having to do anything different.
So on the access end, yeah, that's a whole lot. Basically, it's policy manipulation, but the interpretation to the client is nothing's different. They don't know where it is, and they're still getting a user experience that should be performant. Because as we're saying here, you don't want to have to backhaul, spin them around, flip them up the Direct Connect back, and then you know do all this hairpin stuff. You can give them a direct shot while still retaining full policy enforcement.
Exactly.
So Lisa, this has been a really detailed conversation. I feel like I've been taking notes the whole time, but we do need to wrap. So let's finish up with this question on why would I want to go down this particular route for remote access? What are the benefits?
Well, so a lot of them are the same reasons we moved applications to the cloud. Flexibility, scalability, distribution. With ZPA, we can also eliminate the inbound attack surface and really enable the modernization of enterprise security. So we're moving away from that legacy hub and spoke model with network-centric security controls. We're moving more towards direct-to-cloud access, user and application-centric security. And that gives us consistent policy and visibility across your data center and your multi-cloud environments. So at a high level, we see companies tell us that they are looking to improve their user experience. They want a simpler, more seamless experience for the users, better performance. They want to increase their security. So they want full visibility not only of who is connecting to their network, but what applications they're accessing. And they want that granular level of control. Cost is always a factor. The ability to reduce CapEx by eliminating the VPN appliances and the infrastructure dependency on load balancers, DMZ firewalls, et cetera, gives you the ability to have a cost reduction or even cost avoidance. But you also get a reduction in OpEx for the management overhead of troubleshooting across that stack of appliances or writing security policies in multiple environments. And at the end of the day, it's really the desire to simplify enterprise security, to enable access from any device, from any location, from any user, to any application in any backend environment, but only if it's authorized to do so.
So on that note, if folks want to reach out to Zscaler or get more information, where should they go?
Well, the website zscaler.com. We have landing pages for both Zscaler Internet Access, which would be zscaler.com/ZIA. We also have a landing page for Zscaler Private Access at zscaler.com/ZPA. And you'll find everything from solution briefs, customer testimonials. You can request a demo, and you can even sign up for our hands-on sandbox for ZPA, which is ZPA Interactive.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have all of those links in the show notes. Lisa, thank you for spending the time with us, for being a fantastic guest. And thank you to our listeners. If you like the show, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog. That's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.